QuantSpeak, expert insights from quants for quants.
Welcome to QuantSpeak, a new podcast from the CQF Institute at Fitch Learning.
Hi, I'm Dan Tudball, editor of Wilmot Magazine, and this is QuantSpeak. Take a step with us into the world of spooky action at a distance. No, it's not Halloween just yet, but for many, Einstein's description of quantum entanglement is the beginning and end of their interaction with quantum ideas. This episode, I'm joined by David Orrell, author of Quantum Economics and Finance, an Applied Mathematics Introduction. David is amongst the vanguard of researchers using quantum mechanics to model phenomena including cognition, financial transactions, and the dynamics of money and credit. He'll be presenting a talk for CQF Institute members on applying the theory to pricing options. Welcome, David.
Hi, Dan. Nice to be here.
Great. Thanks a lot for joining us. We had an opportunity to have a chat last year about your work in getting quantum ideas into finance. And also, we're running an article of yours in Wilmot Magazine coming up soon. We'll probably run over some of the points that we've discussed in the past. The first one really is related to a point that you brought up the last time we had a chat, just around the resistance by some physicists, could we call them quantum purists, to ideas from quantum mechanics being applied to areas other than physics. It ignores the fact that these are, in the first instance, mathematical ideas. That was the point you were making to me. And many of the mathematical ideas that underpin the field actually predate quantum mechanics, like the Hilbert space. So your contention is that these ideas are the appropriate mathematical framework for finance.
Yeah, there's something kind of funny about quantum ideas, which is that they've been sort of isolated and just kept to physics. And there's always been this, as you mentioned in the introduction, they're kind of associated with these weird, spooky ideas, and we've always sort of been told by famous physicists and so on that quantum ideas are fundamentally impossible to understand, because they're so bizarre and strange, and things like entanglement and superposition and interference have nothing to do with our everyday lives, and they only apply to subatomic particles. But it's sort of strange because we use calculus was invented for calculating things like the motion of planets and things like that, but we use it for different things. I work in computational biology. I use calculus for that, and without confusing it with sort of cannonballs and so on, and quantum probability and logic is just the same. It's like another kind of mathematics, and it seems especially suited to something like finance, where we're dealing with things like the exchange of information, rather than sort of classical objects in the usual sense. So for example, something like a financial transaction, you can see that as a way of collapsing the fuzzy concept of value down to a numerical price. We can handle that process as a kind of a quantum measurement procedure. So I think, as always, from an applied math point of view, the test is always whether the methods that you're using are outperforming, the classical ones. And so in the talk, I will argue that for some things, at least they do.
The last time we had a chat, we've discussed the idea that the advent and the increasing accessibility of quantum computing actually makes quantum ideas far more tractable for finance researchers and practitioners.
Yeah, I think definitely. So like a good example, again, is the concept of entanglement, which you mentioned. So, when I first kind of came into the area, like most people, I'm thinking of the physics picture and thinking about entanglement in terms of subatomic particles, and it's all very mysterious and Einstein's spooky action at a distance and so on. And it's really hard to get your head around. But like now you can go online and you can write a circuit with an entanglement gate, which entangles sort of two qubits. Therefore, and you can actually run it on a quantum computer. So that makes it, that changes it from being this sort of terribly abstract thing to being just a gate in a computer, which you can use. And so it turns out that you can use a sort of a simple entanglement gate to model a variety of things like the debt relationship, or you can use it to simulate how subjective and objective factors are combined in the mind to make a decision, which is one of the main ideas of quantum cognition. You can allow for effects such as interference. And similar circuits are key to methods such as quantum AI, which is starting to feed into finance. So yeah, I think it's really, you know, like we were saying before, it's sort of like a gateway into using quantum ideas, if you like.
One of my concerns, I mean, the financial industry interest in quantum computing might collapse down to a focus on improvements of speed, efficiency, and security relative to conventional computing. But this would be rather boring compared to the potential that a quantum approach to finance has, for example, in replacing analogies to classical physics that have been foundational for quantitative finance, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think there's sort of a process, because quantum finance has actually been around for a while, like sort of two or three decades. But the focus of the first generation of models was to solve classical techniques like Black-Scholes using quantum methods. So you're sort of seeing quantum mathematics as a toolkit, and you're kind of starting with, you know, you're figuring out how to write, Black-Scholes and rephrase it as a Schrodinger's equation, something like this. And there's a lot of interest in this now, and you're starting to see companies starting to spring up because of the hope that quantum computers will soon be available for use in finance. So that's one part of it. But then there's a sort of a feedback loop, you know, which I mentioned, between computing and the models, because quantum computers, they're intrinsically probabilistic. It's like the way they work is, you know, dealing in probabilities instead of being a deterministic system. They exploit the concepts of superposition, entanglement, and interference to solve problems. So the next generation of quantum models is saying, sort of, hang on, you know, the financial system is an inherently probabilistic system which features entanglement, interference, and so on. So, you know, when you look at it that way, then quantum models seem a very natural choice. And of course, they have the advantage that they are native to quantum computers.
Is there any sort of relationship that you might work out between a quantum approach and, say, an agent-based approach?
Yeah, I think so. Like, as an example, in an agent-based approach, you might have sort of like one of the simplest ways to do it is have some agents who are fundamental. You know, they're operating according to decisions about fundamental value, and other ones are operating on decisions about momentum, right? And so you could sort of imagine that the fundamental aspect is sort of the objective way of looking at prices. Either they're too high or too low according to some metric. And the momentum approach is more, you can think of that as kind of more emotion-driven response, where, you know, the price is going up and people get excited and they want to buy more. When prices are going down, they get alarmed and they start to dump their holdings. And so in a, you know, sort of classical, if you like, agent-based model, you might have a mix of these two different agents. So with a quantum approach, one thing that you can do is actually combine those in the minds of a single agent, you know, so you can have the objective and the subjective factors, but entangled with one another. And again, just using a very simple circuit. So it kind of gives you a whole different way of modeling a quantum agent, if you like. And how, you know, again, sort of the ultimate test of something like this is going to be its performance, right? And so it's sort of too early to say at the moment, but it sort of gives you another way of approaching agent-based models, so sort of quantum agent-based models. You can look at entanglement between agents, for example, sort of see how they're influencing one another.
Quantitative finance has a funny sort of relationship with mainstream economics. In your writing, certainly, there is sort of a difference between the way that quantitative finance and mainstream economics would conduct or have a relationship with quantum ideas. Could you sort of lay that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, they share a lot, obviously, right? Because they're both based on, you know, modeling financial transactions. And the quantum approach allows you to reconcile these objective and subjective factors in a probabilistic manner. So something like the relationship. I mean, both of them, you got this sort of fuzzy idea of value and hard number price, and how do you reconcile these? And, you know, so this is kind of the heart of the quantum approach. But I think the difference, and, you know, one advantage really of quantitative finance, well, first of all, computational speed is obviously very important, which explains the interest in quantum computing. So You know, again, that can act as sort of a gateway where interest in quantum computing spills over to quantum ideas more generally. But another thing is about quantitative finance. Like if you sort of think, okay, you've got a new theory and you want to test it on something, then quantitative finance, you have these really sort of well-posed questions which can be tested using historical data. So my talk is going to focus on option pricing, which of course is one of the oldest problems in finance. And it's kind of, you know, it's just sort of nicely defined thing and much easier to kind of test your ideas on than something like, you know, macroeconomics.
And you've touched on like the concept of money as well. How would that be handled in a quantum framework?
For me, actually, money was kind of my way into this entire thing, you know, because I wrote a book about, it's called The Evolution of Money, and it was kind of like a history of how money had developed, and then I was thinking that money has these sort of two main historical theories of money. There's this sort of bullionism idea that money is kind of a thing, you know, like gold or silver, which has this inherent value. And then you have the chartalism theory, which is the idea that money is credit, you know, so it's just a sort of a virtual number and has these dual real virtual properties. But neither of these pictures are kind of complete, you know. So if you have something like Bitcoin, for example, on the one hand, it looks completely virtual, but on the other hand, it's very real, as you find out if you happen to lose the hard drive in which your Bitcoins are located, right? So with money, you've always got the real and the virtual kind of bound together. And so that kind of inherent duality kind of leads you towards a bit of a quantum approach. And then you start thinking, okay, what is money used for? Well, it's used for kind of taking this sort of fuzzy subjective idea of value and collapsing it down to a hard number, the price. And so, you know, this is like something that we can model using wave function collapse, which is a method from quantum mechanics. So money is kind of, for me, it was the way into this whole, you know, quantum way of modeling things. And then what's interesting is that in mainstream economics, sort of, you know, the classical approach, money doesn't have these interesting properties at all. You know, so like money is traditionally, in economics, it's being measured as sort of like a metric, or it's an inert medium of exchange. But, you know, the big sort of theorems from economics don't usually even mention money at all. You know, it's sort of, the economy is viewed as a sort of a barter system where people are just trading goods. I mean, since the time of Adam Smith, he saw money as kind of a veil over the so-called real economy. And one advantage of the quantum approach is that it starts with the concept of money. It looks at how money is, you know, how money is created, how money is used in transactions to put prices on things. And many of the kind of main phenomena which, you know, we deal with in the economy are actually, they have to do with the money system, you know, like something like money creation by private banks and so on. You know, things like real estate markets and so on. They're not driven so much by these kind of, you know, so-called real things like supply and demand in the usual sense. A lot of it has got to do with the dynamics of money. So I think, you know, the quantum approach, it kind of starts with money, if you like.
It's a very appealing way to think about things, to think in a quantum way, I think. I've seen that things have developed from qubits to qutrits. What's that all about?
Well, a qubit has two orthonormal basis states. So it's like the quantum version of a classical bit. So instead of being zero or one, it represents a superposition state of zero and one, which will yield either zero or one when measured. So it's a bit like Hamlet being in a superposition state of to be and not to be. A qutrit has three orthonormal basis states. So it's like Hamlet being in a state of to be, not to be, and none of the above. However, I would like to reassure any listeners that I'm not going to discuss Qutrit.
Or Shakespeare,
indeed.
And should we be excited about micron-sized entangled aluminium drums? Because, you know, now things are happening in the classical space, it seems.
Yeah, definitely we should. Well, there's a famous principle in quantum physics known as Bohr's correspondence principle, which says that quantum effects wash out at large scale. So this experiment is sort of further evidence that quantum effects such as entanglement actually do scale up sometimes. So they're not limited to subatomic particles, and it kind of opens up the potential for a role of quantum effects in things like biology and cognition. And I think those kinds of developments are certainly promised to change the conversation in quantum social science, where there's like this interest in a physical link between quantum physics and human cognition. But I think for the purposes of finance, the idea is a little different, because it's not so much like, you know, the brain is quantum, or that, you know, we got like little drums in our brains or whatever. It's the idea is that money can be modeled using quantum methods, and its effects scale up through the technology known as the financial system. So, you don't need to look at these, micron sized drums or whatever, because financial entanglement is right there in the wording of a loan contract. Like, it's the money system is something that we invented. And so, you know, in order to decide whether it's quantum or not, we can just, you know, look at it and decide for ourselves.
Going back to how important is it to finance that quantum approaches fundamentally embrace subjectivity?
You know, again, like, just as mainstream economics sort of left out money, it's also left out subjectivity. Actually, there's a social scientist, you know, was reading a book, and, you know, he was saying that there's been sort of a taboo on subjectivity in the social sciences. Which is just sort of jumps out at you as kind of so strange, right? Because I mean, surely the social sciences is supposed to be about subjectivity, you know, and what we think, and about human relationships and so on. So how is it that we're kind of leaving this out? And so that's true in the social sciences. It's kind of especially true in economics, where money is being left out, and everything has been on this idea of rational people, you know, settling on the objective value. And of course, you know, we know that money has tremendous kind of psychoactive effects on the human mind, right? I mean, it's all, you know, money is in sort of an intensely emotional subject, right? So you kind of see why, you know, mainstream economics didn't really want to deal with it. And so, you know, instead we've had this ideas like, you know, efficient market theory and whatnot that say that basically price represents objective value. But, you know, the reality is that the value of something is fundamentally subjective. So, you know, that's why otherwise marketers wouldn't have a job, right? So similarly, the value of an option, you know, if you think if you're taking out an option on an asset, you normally do it because you have some kind of opinion, and probably a subjective opinion about its future, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. You just have an opinion about it. And I think behavioral economics take some of these factors into account, but it's really more like a tweak or an adjustment to classical methods. And there are many sort of so-called cognitive paradoxes, you know, that are best modeled using quantum methods, exactly because they can capture this interplay between subjective and objective forces.
Quantum mechanics has a century-old history now. I mean, more than that. Why do you think it took so long to get to this point? I mean, you've already referred to the fact that research has been done over the last 30 years. What are the various streams that have sort of led to this confluence where we're able to talk about this now in a really serious way?
That's sort of like a really interesting kind of sociological or question or something for, you know, about science. And I think there are like a number of reasons for it, that there has been this kind of worry about taking quantum ideas and applying them to sort of any other field. But it does seem strange. I mean, and it's kind of like, for example, you know, that you often read the things like superposition, entanglement, interference, they're these bizarre things, and you'll never encounter them in your everyday life. And so it's, you know, students should not be put off by the fact that they're so weird and all this kind of thing. And then you're kind of thinking, really? I mean, entanglement is like an old word, you know, and we've used it for discussing, you know, human entanglement, but also, you know, financial. Keynes talked about financial entanglements, for example, before the word was ever applied in physics. So it's kind of, it's odd that, and actually, you know, some of the ideas, like, for example, superposition, the idea that something can be in two states at the same time, that was actually borrowed from the idea in psychology, from, you know, psychologists, that you could hold two ideas in the mind at the same time and there would be this conflict between them. And so quantum physicists, you know, actually, they actually borrowed that idea from psychology. And somehow we've kind of got to the point where, you know, even though it came from psychology, applying it to psychology is considered like this, you know, kind of abuse of physics or something like that, right? So it's sort of an odd thing. And I think, you know, there are a number of reasons. I think one thing is, like, physicists have kind of very really resisted any attempt by other people to, you know, use this, because they see it as like a misuse or an abuse of the physics. But I always think, like, if you want to talk about, like, the misuse or abuse of physics, then, you know, you got lots of examples of that, right? Like, in we use mechanistic ideas borrowed from mechanistic physics to model things, like, you know, in standard economics, and these methods have not done very well at all, you know, and so, you know, why is it okay to use those ones but not to use quantum ones? But I think the good, so you know, I think there's sort of like a bunch of obviously very, very strong reasons why we haven't been using quantum ideas, exactly because it's been over a century and they've been kept in, like, their little compartment. But if you just look now, you can see it's actually starting to kind of lift, and people have been working on interest, I would say, grew from, for example, Roger Penrose, the physicist. He had this theory that cognitive processes had to be based on quantum processes because, you know, classical kind of processes just wouldn't do it in terms of cognition. And, you know, maybe it was starting around there. And then you started to get people modeling cognitive and psychological phenomena, kind of exactly the sort of same thing that you do in behavioral psychology, but looking at it from a quantum point of view. And so there are these kind of two strands. One is, like, the idea that we're actually quantum beings, if you like. There is another strand, which is more like quantum-like modeling, where you say, and they kind of, you know, that other strand, they're careful to distance themselves, and they say, you know, in all their papers, they start by saying, you know, we are not implying that, you know, the brain is quantum. We're just saying that these models happen to work, so let's give them a shot, kind of thing. And so so there are these two strands. And I think from the point of view of, And then, you know, as I mentioned, there's this interest in finance, because, which kind of grew out of the fact that, okay, Black-Scholes is sort of a probabilistic, you know, kind of wave equation type thing that you can reconfigure it a bit as a Schrodinger kind of quantum equation, and then you apply quantum methods to solve it. So that was kind of a very technical application. So I think from the point of view of, that, you know, I'm kind of presenting, it's sort of saying, well, it's sort of agnostic about, you know, brain processes, because, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, I know nothing about that, right? So it's like, but I don't think it matters, because if you sort of said, for example, there are arguments that some species, like, for example, birds, use quantum, they exploit kind of quantum methods to navigate, you know, but you know, so that might be true, but that doesn't mean that you would, as an applied mathematician, you're going to model birds using quantum mechanics, right? So I'm looking at it from the applied math kind of point of view. So I'm, so, you know, so it's kind of like, look at the money system as a quantum system in its own right. So it's like the quantum like approach, like that, but without the like, okay? Because it's like, you know, when we use calculus to model something in biology or in economics, we don't say it's a calculus-like approach. We just say we're using calculus. And so I think that's the right spirit to use this in. So the map is not from subatomic physics to finance or the economy. The map is from a mathematical model to either physics or to, you know, to finance. So it's like, so it's putting the emphasis on, this is a mathematical modeling technique, and we use it if it works, and we think it's very well suited for work in economics and finance.
How difficult is it to communicate that to colleagues, to academics, to practitioners? Have you gotten into any fistfights yet?
No. It's very, very hard to convince anyone who is kind of not wanting to hear. There are a lot of blockers, basically, is what I found, you know. So, and it just makes sense, because if something has been sort of sitting there in the toolkit for over a century and no one has been using it, then obviously there are lots of reasons why we shouldn't be using it, right? And so, for example, something like entanglement is a kind of a trigger word for a lot of people, because if they're trained in physics, they will be thinking, okay, entanglement is this thing that, you know, we invented to describe, and it's the reality of how electrons or, you know, photons or whatever, they can have this weird thing where a measurement on one kind of acts as a, you know, tells you something about this other partner, which, you know, even if it's on the other side of the universe, and it's all terribly spooky and weird. So that's, you know, that's, I think that acts as kind of a blocker once you kind of have that in your head, and then you kind of go, oh no, you know, dollar bills are not entangled. So, you know, this is just kind of a misuse of the theory. But what you need to do is kind of stand back and say, okay, look, let's build a mathematical model of the system using entanglement. And, you know, can you do it? And is it correct in, you know, given the, as a sort of, as a model, is it doing the right things? And that's like that's a different question. So I think, in terms of communicating, it's really been the, you know, we talk about kind of science communications, right? And this is like, it's very difficult to communicate. I mean, and I've kind of been through sort of a process of different ways of doing it. But I do feel like it's getting a bit easier now, just because, and part of it really has been the interest in quantum computing, you know, because there is this kind of feedback loop between the tools that we use and the ideas. And so, you know, we've been thinking in a classical way for a long time. And part of that is because we've been programming on classical computers. But once people start getting their heads around quantum computers, then that also starts to change the way that you think about other things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the ideas drawn from quantum cognition that lead us to modeling a quantum walk in the context of pricing an option?
The traditional method for pricing options is based on, you know, the idea that prices follow a random walk. And so the net expectation for profit is zero, and the variance grows to the square root of time. So it's a decreasing rate. And so it's this kind of very kind of calm, you know, ordered picture of how things are going to happen, you know, as things spread out into the future. And the problem is that if investors actually believe this, I don't think there would be any point in buying options in the first place, you know, because there would be no expectation of profit, and there would be little concern about extreme price changes, you know. So there's kind of like a paradox there. And also, if this model was really true and everybody agreed to it, then prices should kind of conform perfectly to the classical model, and volume should be uniform. And, you know, we know that's not the case, because you get things like the volatility smile, and you get big differences in volume as a function of strike price. So that's sort of the problem. And the quantum version of a random walk is known as a quantum walk, and is very different. So instead of dealing with like the pinball type thing, where you kind of start off and you take a random bounce to the left or the right, and you kind of keep going, and then you see how far you diverge. So the quantum walk is kind of exploring all of these states simultaneously as it evolves. But then you have these interference effects, which mean that the distribution which you get is, when you measure it down at the bottom at the end, is quite different from the normal distribution, as we'll see. In fact, it's extremely different. And for one thing, it assumes that prices grow or decrease at a linear rate so much more quickly. So if you sort of think of projecting growth into the future, instead of saying that it's going to go in this kind of square root type fashion, kind of taper off, you're just going to imagine it going at a kind of a continuous linear rate, 10% per year, something like that. So In the talk, we're going to use the quantum approach to come up with an alternative pricing model and also discuss how it can be implemented on a quantum device.
How soon do you think people are actually going to be putting this into practical use? There used to be that great show, what was it called? Quantum Leap. And he was able to travel backwards in time. In your case, if you had a way of actually traveling into the future, do you think you will see quantum approaches being applied in a sort of a widely adopted way?
I think so. I think there's kind of a typical estimate of this thing is that quantum computers might be ready for finance in around 5 years' time. I think Goldman Sachs, for example, made that prediction recently. But I think one difference is that the focus has always been on quantum computers as being a kind of a completely programmable device, you know, so like the something like a classical computer, but running on quantum gates. And that's, you know, very complicated, obviously, right? Because I right now, I mean, you know, the quantum computers are just at this very basic state and they're incredibly expensive and so on. But I think there's scope for quantum devices. So something like a quantum walk, for example, you don't actually need a full-blown quantum computer. You just need a quantum device which can do a quantum walk, which is much simpler. And so something like that is definitely within reach within a few years, I would say. And I think one thing that I'd be interested to sort of see come out of this talk is to see what other people think about, like, what are the main limitations and kind of the computational limitations, where can the quantum approach help in kind of speeding up the process, where it can kind of add the most. So I think that's a really good question. But I think, like, at the moment, we need to explore, because there's an awful lot that you can do without needing a full-blown computer. There's a lot of scope for bringing in quantum methods at kind of like a cheaper and more accessible rate, if you like.
Great. Thanks, David. The most important question, Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Wars or Star Trek? I've got to admit, I was never really into Star Wars or Star Trek, to be honest. So I don't have any kind of good references like that.
That's just part of your quantum nature, I think. That particular wave hasn't collapsed yet.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to go with the Q-trit thing, you know, none of the above.
That's great. What's your next venture? I mean, are you working on a new book at the moment?
Not right now. We have a second edition of this book coming out soon. I'm just waiting for the copy to arrive, actually, to kind of check it. And then hopefully it'll be out before the talk. And kind of continuing trying to apply quantum methods to different problems in economics.
Thanks very much for joining us, David. I'm sure I'll be tuning in for the talk. In the meantime, all the best.
Okay, thanks very much, Dan.
Cheerio.
Thank you for listening to QuantSpeak. Don't forget to subscribe and do sign up to the CQF Institute for more insights into quant finance.